My guest is playwright Albert Inarritu. His three best-known plays have just been collected in a new book. His Obie Award-winning play, The Transfiguration of Benno Blimpie, is about an obese adolescent consumed by self-hatred who decides to eat himself to death. Inarritu's Broadway hit, Gemini, is about a plump, somewhat clumsy Harvard student who's back home for the summer in his Italian working-class South Philadelphia neighborhood. His insecurities are set off when he's paid a visit by a beautiful WASP classmate and her trim, handsome brother. His crisis is further complicated when their visit causes him to realize he's unsure of whether he's straight or gay. Inarritu's most recent play, Coming of Age in Soho, was produced by Joseph Papp. It's about a playwright who thinks he's lost his talent. He's gay and is separating from his wife. At the same time, he meets his son, a son he never knew he fathered, in a short-lived relationship about 16 years before. Inarritu has also written for television, including the PBS Verna USO Girl, which starred Sissy Spacek. Aspects of Albert Inarritu's life appear in his plays. He grew up in an Italian neighborhood in South Philadelphia, where he attended Catholic school. He later studied at Yale Drama School, where he collaborated on a play with Christopher Durang that starred another classmate, Meryl Streep. Albert Inarritu's new collection of plays is called The Best Plays of Albert Inarritu, and it's just been published by the Gay Presses of New York. Welcome to
Thank
Fresh
you.
Air. I'm going to read you a quote that you had said in an interview back in 1978, and we'll see if it's still true or not. You said, "All my plays deal with outcasts who try to succeed in a society that ostracizes them very readily and very easily. I think we live in a society almost totally geared to the cosmetic." Still stand by that?
Oh, I think it's truer today than it was even then.
How so?
Well, I think that one thing that I've noticed is that in the 60s and 70s, there were people who hated women and hated gay people and hated black people and hated the notion of individuality and hated the notion of free choice. But they thought twice about expressing that hatred. And I think during the Reagan administration, the past 8 years, we've seen it become respectable for these vicious bigots to attack people. I've heard on national television people who've died of AIDS called perverts. When the people I know who've died of AIDS, and I unfortunately know too many, have been decent taxpaying citizens like anybody. I've heard all kinds of viciousness spewed out about unconforming people, whether they're women who dare to feel that they should have some control over their bodies, or whether they're men or women who have an unconventional sexual choice. And it's become more respectable. And I think in the 70s, it was a little less respectable to be that hate-filled and that bigoted. So I think it's become more so.
You said that your plays are usually about outcasts or people who see themselves as outcasts. Have you always felt like an outcast yourself?
Yeah, I think so.
By virtue of?
Well, I'm a fat person in a thin society. I'm a gay person or a mostly gay person in a society where that's now a terrible thing to be. I think there was a time when it was a little more acceptable, but I think now it's become a cross to bear again. Many of the people I know are frightened of the potential for violence and repression, and people using AIDS as an excuse to oppress and blame people as opposed to seeing it as a terrible human tragedy that could afflict anybody. So that is, I think, as a playwright in dying theater, one is automatically an outcast. As someone who loves literature and opera and classical music, at a time when those things seem to be dead. And I teach this semester at Princeton. I teach in the Graduate School at Columbia. So I get to see just how uninformed and unformed our youngsters are, including our brightest youngsters. I mean, their frame of reference doesn't include anything except television and movies.
You know, I think you really put yourself on the line in your plays. Everybody assumes that novels and plays are autobiographical, mm-hmm. whether they are or not. It's just always an assumption that's made. Your first play was, well, your first very well-known play was about someone who's very fat. Mm-hmm. Your plays have been about people who were gay before you necessarily came out. And your latest play is about a playwright who fears he's lost his talent. So readers would think like, okay, well, we know that the playwright is someone who's overweight, gay, and who fears he's lost his talent. did you ever think of, did you ever worry about people just being able to make presumptions about your life, whether you wanted your life to be public or not?
The irony always is, and I tell my students who write plays and then get very frightened and very inhibited, and I find this is true of women especially. Mm-hmm. I think some women are terribly self-censoring. I never realized that until I encountered them.
That's an interesting thing to say.
Yes. I think women are socialized to be very self-denying. And even the brightest young women I know in the playwriting classes are always self-censoring. Whereas the least talented male will always promote himself. And these quite talented and quite interesting women will always apologize for what they've come up with. It's very interesting, even if they have a feminist line. In fact, they're terribly self-lacerating. But I have written a play called Gus and Al, and it will be done at Playwrights Horizons this year. That's this theater run in New York, which is done on a great many plays by me. It started Gemini, did my production of Ben O'Blimpy, which I directed, did a play called Herself is Lust, Earthworms. And Gus and Al is about Albert Inarrado, a fat, failed playwright who travels back in time and meets up with Gustav Mahler. And it was done in a workshop in Denver last year. And one of the things that was said to me was, well, you know, some people liked it and some people who didn't like it didn't like it. But everyone, liked it, whether they liked it or not, said, isn't it terrible that you put yourself in this play? Because I'm Al, obviously. And I said, well, when I wrote Coming of Age in Soho, which is a very, very fictionalized piece. There are autobiographical elements, but I defy anyone who doesn't know my life in great detail to pick them out. Mostly, it's fiction. Nonetheless, the Variety Review, which, although it's written by a moron who doesn't even sign his entire name, is taken seriously by all our artistic theaters, said Albert Inarrado is a simple-minded, idiotic, narcissistic, appalling homosexual whose only talent is in getting his plays on. And I said to these people in Denver, and I say to everyone who asks me about that play, if someone, some fool who signs his name H-U-M-M, I don't know what that connotes, can publish that and be read and believed by people who will never read the play themselves and will never see the play themselves, then why not? What worse can be said? They're going to say it anyway. And if I felt it was important to write about my life, then I'm going to. Because those hate-filled morons will say what they're going to say. You know, if I wrote as a woman, I'm sure, and thought up in a completely false name and fooled everyone, you'd still read, well, this is her life. And how dare she inflict it on us? So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's...
Right. My guest is playwright Albert Inarrado, and three of his plays have just been compiled in a new anthology, which is called The Best Plays of Albert Inarrado. It seems to me that your interest in theater started when you were a child and you loved opera.
Yes, I was born with this deranged chromosome. I think I'm missing a chromosome or I have an extra one. I don't know. But I was naturally drawn to opera and the theater.
You know, I remember in my neighborhood, the kids who love classical music were made fun of, but opera was considered like beyond the pall.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's still considered beyond the pall, even by all kinds of people. They can be quite civilized and genteel. They still think you've got to be basically very sick.
Did you take a lot of grief for that when you were young?
Well, I don't know. I mean, probably no more for that and for lots of other things. I mean, I was kind of your classical chubby sissy, so, I mean, you always get targeted. You know, if I had loved football and, you know... And young girls in skirts, I still would have been, to some degree, picked on and made fun of. So, yeah, I think I took a certain amount of grief for it.
You went to Catholic school.
Well, I went to Catholic grade school. Then for those people in Philadelphia,
then
I went to Central.
Right, which is the school for smart kids.
In those days, anyway, I don't know what's happened to it since. But, I mean, yeah. So, I mean, that was a big escape for me. It was a lucky thing.
Do you feel that you were shaped at all by the Catholic school?
Oh, yes, experience? Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there's a revisionism that... in the Catholic Church, and it's very funny. I mean, and I know, you know, quite decent people who don't believe my stories about nuns. But unfortunately, the first women I met were these vicious nuns. They were Irish nuns, and they hated little Italian boys. And they were really terribly, terribly aggressive and punitive and very unpleasant, and they were monstrous. Now, I know there are many brave and wonderful nuns in the world who are not like this, but unfortunately, my view of Catholicism was pre-Vatican II Catholicism, whereas if you dared to eat meat on Friday, you went to hell for eternity, for example. If you didn't fast a full 12 hours before taking the host, God was going to come and get you that night. And there was this gigantic nun in the sky who was going to swoop down and catch you if you touched yourself. You know, if you looked at the wrong TV program, if you dared to read a novel that was on that list. So that was so I do think it shaped me. I'm still sort of fighting to get out of that notion of that nun up there that's going to swoop down and punish me.
Your character in Gemini is very self-conscious about his working-class background and coming from this row house-type neighborhood. Yeah. And he's also very self-conscious about being kind of clumsy and kind of chubby with all these, like, really trim, good-looking, more wealthy people around. Did you have that experience when you went to Yale?
Well, I wouldn't say it was all that simple. I mean, it was never quite – I mean, I had that experience probably more vigorously at Central because I really had never met anybody who wasn't an Italian or Jewish. Our neighborhood was Italian and Jewish, and you sort of needed a scorecard to tell the difference. And up at Central, finally, I met upper-middle-class people. And we were not by any means deprived or starving in the street. But I think that it was very definitely, though, a working class, a lower middle class milieu. No one's parents had been to college. No one really read or thought of themselves as educated. And suddenly go to Central and meet, you know, I never had met a WASP, a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, before I went to Central. I had never met upper middle class or wealthy people. I'd never met people whose parents were terribly interested in intellectual things or who were distinguished. So it was really, and to be a high school kid without the resources, you know, with that kind of clumsy thing that happens in high school was very disconcerting. And I think the germ of the play was probably more high school than college, because by college I had sort of, you know, developed my own way of dealing with it. But it took me a while to...
When you were in college, you were in one of those Yale Drama School classes that...
Drama School, yes.
Yeah, that gave birth to all these great...
No, it was an amazing class. It really was an amazing class.
It was Christopher Durang, the playwright.
Yes, Wendy Wasserstein, another quite distinguished playwright. Sigourney Weaver, famous actress. Meryl Streep. James Lapine, who is doing In the Woods now with Stephen Sondheim and just did Sundays in the Park with George 2 years ago. Was around. It was an extraordinary class. It was really extraordinary.
Did you realize it at the time?
Yes. Yes. I think we were all very impressed with ourselves.
Were you vicious and jealous?
No, because I tell you, the drama school was. I have to say that what happened there was that it was so punitive that we all were very. We tended to cling to one another for sanity and endurance. They threw out half my class the first year, and they did it publicly. So they had accepted all these people, and then they just threw everybody out. They kept 9 out of 18, and they announced who they were throwing out in front of someone. Someone got up. I don't want to name who it was. Got up and said, "I'm going to call a group of names, and please leave if I call your name because you are no longer one of us." And they called these names, and you watched people go out. It was horrible. It was a horrifying thing. And they were always evaluating people in public and doing things like saying, you know, you're hopeless, you're preposterous, you're always late, you dress badly. It was amazing. It was a very cruel. So when I read these books, there's a new book about Juilliard out. And when I read these books, the books about it, and the book is written as though it's shocking that a piano teacher might throw the music out the window or throw a tantrum. Well, no, it isn't. That's nothing.
Well, that seems to me to be a very minor part of the difficulty and actually of the suffering that you went through to achieve a life in the arts. And I'm thinking about when you first came to New York and you were broke.
Oh, I've had many a nightmare in my life.
And you were sick part of that time,
I
too.
Got very sick. Yes, I had had this operation at Yale, which was I had a chronic condition that was minor but unfortunate to have. But they had invented this operation, and I was one of the first people it was done on in this country. It was actually invented in England. And I was a student at Yale, and it was done for free, and I got all this care. But it was an experimental operation. And I came to New York, and I had some odd jobs, and I got a Guggenheim grant. And about a week after the Guggenheim grant ran out, I got a job as a messenger because I really had to keep myself afloat. And this operation literally unraveled, and I began to hemorrhage, which was one of the side effects that they really didn't know what happened until it happened. And I didn't have health insurance. I had a minor health insurance plan, but they would not cover pre-existing conditions, which is a typical problem with insurance companies. And this was a pre-existing condition, and the period of time which needs to elapse hadn't elapsed. And I was reduced to begging people. I was very sick. I had a high fever. I was in agony, and I had a lot of pain, and I was scared. And I went through firsthand people go through when you suddenly have nothing. When I see bag people in this country, I know exactly what that feels like, to sit in a Medicaid office bleeding and to be told, well, we can't help you. You're white, or who would ever believe you can't, your family won't help you. And they were poor. My family were not well-to-do and suffered through it, but I mean, there was not much they could do. And I don't always tell the whole story, but the doctor at Yale, you know, said, you've got to come back. You're very sick. We have to do something. You know, you're bleeding. You have this high fever and you're infected and all of this stuff. I mean, you have an infection that was going through your system. I went to the hospital in New Haven. They said, where's your insurance? I said, well, I won't cover this, unfortunately. They said, well, we need $3,000 in cash today or we won't admit you. And I was bleeding. So I went back to New York. I couldn't raise that sum of money. I was reduced to begging people. And you find out, as I tell people sometimes, young people, when I meet them, no one's going to help you. It's one of the first lessons in life.
But isn't this the kind of time when you ask yourself, maybe I should have gone into the insurance business instead of playwriting? Does that bring out your insecurities about making a living in the world of the arts?
Oh, yes, everything does. But I'll finish the story. I came back to New York and I had to sit in a Medicaid office, and they said, well, the only way we could possibly give you money would be in a week. You know, I needed this operation like yesterday.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, it has to be done by someone in New York City, in Manhattan. And I said, well, it's a special operation. It was done in New Haven. They said, well, you've got to go to New Haven Welfare and see if they'll help you. Well, I wasn't a resident of New Haven, so I couldn't help there. So the doctor said, come and you spend a night in my garage, and at 7 o'clock in the morning, you go out and lie in the street, and I'll call an ambulance.
Oh, no.
And they'll rush you to the hospital, and they cannot refuse you by federal law. They can't refuse to admit someone who's brought in an ambulance, whether they have insurance or not. And that's how we'll get you in, and that's what we did.
That's remarkable.
That's really what happened. That's how I got in the hospital that time. So, you know, I learned. So, yes, I know, but it has never occurred to me not to be what I am, unfortunately. I mean, and as well, since I'm teaching now, I do tell students, you know, if you really can do something else and be happy, I advise you to do it. It's a very tough profession, and I don't know that there's anybody who is an exception, really. Any writers now, you know, great actors. Actors can make substantial sums of money if they become movie or television stars. A playwright like Sam Shepard, who's become a movie star, is making much more in movies than he ever made from his plays, though he's one of our more successful playwrights. But most playwrights and writers, period, do poorly, even ones you've heard of and think do well.
My guest is playwright Albert Inarritu, and his plays include The Transfiguration of Ben O'Blimpie, Gemini, and Coming of Age in Soho. And we're going to talk some more about theater after we take this short break. This is Fresh Air. Playwright Albert Inarritu is my guest, and three of his plays have just been issued in a new book called The Best Plays of Albert Inarritu. I think one of the difficult things for any playwright who's getting started is getting their play staged. And in those early days when you're getting your plays staged, it's not necessarily going to be the most professional production. Did you ever have troubles with that when you were starting?
Well, not when I was starting. You see, I think as I mentioned in the introduction in this book, we had a theater in those days between 1975 and 1979. It was a theater of poverty. But you did have a community of theater people, actors and directors, who were theater people who wanted to do new plays and were staying in Manhattan to do new plays. And in those days, you could live in Manhattan on relatively little. Rents were not sky high. And we all hoped that Broadway would revive any day and rescue us. So actually, the first productions I got in Manhattan, though everyone worked for free, this is off Broadway, tended to be pretty good. I had Meryl Streep in my play. Sigourney Weaver was in the very first thing, performance of Gemini. You know, actors who are very respectable now, I don't know if their names will be known, Anna Salvo, John Polito. People you see on television, all the Reed Birney, whether you recognize them or not, Danny Aiello, were all in my plays. But that's because I mentioned in the book that Gemini was first read in the living room of Mike Tucker and Jill Eikenberry of L.A. Law. And Bruce Weitz, who went on to Hill Street Blues, read The Father. And Danny DeVito, who was in Taxi, was there with some girlfriend. And it was an extraordinary feeling of community and of these people. Now, I would say 90% of them have fled. They've really gone to L.A. And they are working in television or in movies or trying to. And I think what has happened in Manhattan is that most people are not stage-oriented in Manhattan. If they want to be actors or directors in Manhattan, they're looking to break in on the East Coast into movies and TV because that's the only way there's a hunger for product in television and movies and you can work. And so I think what's happened in the past 7 or 8 years in Manhattan is that there's been a radical diminution of really good theater people, actors and directors, and that does affect staging. So I've had more trouble subsequently.
Do you work closely with the director who's
Well, I've directed a lot of my own work. I directed Coming of Age in Soho in two versions of the Public Theater with Joe Papp breathing down my neck. I directed a production of Ben O'Blimpie at Playwrights Horizons, which did pretty well. I've directed around the country. I've directed some plays. I've directed Ben O'Blimpie in London. No more. After Coming of Age in Soho, I nearly thought I thought I would die, and so therefore I have sworn not to direct my own stuff again.
What's the problem with directing it yourself?
Well, I don't think there should be a problem with directing anything yourself, but there's an enormous bias against writers in this theater. It's a bias among reviewers. It's a bias among producers. There's a feeling that writers are incompetent for the stage. And so therefore, you have to buck the tide if you direct, and that's a very difficult. And then secondly, it's because we write plays only for reviewers, you realize there is no audience for the average new play in America. And your only hope is to get sufficiently good reviews that you can either get a grant or a TV job. It's the only way you can possibly live, or that some European producer gets interested having read the review and decides to do the play there. Or you get a movie sale because some movie person reads the review and thinks it looks interesting. That's why the Variety review is important. Therefore, we're only writing plays for reviewers. And that being the case, there's no point in investing yourself, because I don't know any reviewers who come with an open mind. They write their reviews on the subway or in the cab to the theater. They're not all fools or dishonest. Some of them are bright and some of them are fair. But I don't know that directing your own play does anything for you, because they've already decided when they get there, pretty much.
You obviously are not pleased with the work of the New York critics. Let me ask you something about Coming of Age in Soho. That was your first play in, I think, 4 years?
Yeah.
Is it dangerous to be out of circulation for 4 years?
Well, yes, and it was very hard to get it produced, actually. No one wanted to do it. I've never had a mainstream success, though Gemini is one of the longer-running plays since the 60s in America. And was successful around the country, actually. It was done a lot around the country. But I'm not a popular playwright. Gemini was not a much admired play in the profession, and I'm not widely liked in the profession, and that has a lot to do with it. Maybe the plays are lousy. There's always that possibility. I prefer to think they aren't. But no, it was difficult to get the plays on. It's difficult to get these two new plays on. I'll have two new on this year, but it's been hard.
Were you writing during that four-year period?
Yeah, I wrote a novel called Yankee Diva. I wrote various drafts of plays. It was very difficult. I had a very hard time in my 30s. Norman Mailer cursed me in my 30s. I was in those days, I wanted to have an income when I was just – Gemini happened when I had just turned 30. So in my other 30s, I wanted to have an income, and I did a lot of TV and movie things. And I was out in California once, and I had breakfast with Norman Mailer at the Beverly Hills Hotel. And it was with Norman Mailer and Jules Pfeiffer. And I'm not a morning person, as those who heard me speak this morning at the music festival here know by this point, unfortunately. But I was in a very bad mood this particular morning, and the waiters kept ignoring me. They were bringing Jules and Norman their breakfast, and I'm sitting there. You know, I'm a large person, so I needed my coffee and carbohydrate quick, and they weren't bringing it. And finally, I banged on the table and said, "Can I get service here?" And Norman looked at me and he said, "You know, you will be miserable in your 30s because I was." So he cursed me. Whenever I see him, I say, "You cursed me, Norman," because my 30s were very difficult. And I had a hard time adjusting both to the success of Gemini and to the failure of Gemini, because I don't believe that any of the lies circulated about Gemini were true. I think they're lies. I heard that play described as a sellout. I heard it described as a cartoon, and it's not. It wasn't. There was a commercial that ran in the New York area that was 30 seconds long, and it emphasized some of the big laughs in the show. But the show was a lie. If you read it, and of course most reviewers can't read, we understand that, but if you actually read the play, you find that that isn't the case. So I had a schizophrenic experience, and it was hard to adjust to that.
In Coming of Age in Soho, the playwright character, the main character, says he's 36 and he's thinking, like, maybe I've lost my talent.
Uh-huh.
And he's saying, "I wasn't a success. I wasn't significant. I was a trend."
Yes.
Is that something you were feeling?
Oh,
at
yes.
Some point
I think
yourself?
It's something. I said this morning and raised a lot of hackles, but I think it's true. It was right about Philip Glass this morning. I mean, I admire and respect Philip Glass, but when someone used him as an example of a serious artist who can attract an audience, I said, is that a serious artist spontaneously attracting his audience through his magic of his music, or is he a trend who has luckily gotten the lottery number this year and is being promoted? And unfortunately, I think in all of our serious arts, that's often how it works. You become a brand name for a time, and then they turn on you.
You know what I wanted to ask you? We opened the interview by talking about a quote that you said in 1978 about how we live in a society almost totally geared to the cosmetic. And I know I've seen a poster or blown-up photo of you from, I guess, the late 70s or something, where you were much thinner.
Yes, no, my weight has gone up and down in my life, yes.
Yeah, are there times when you get more concerned with fitting the cosmetics of the society, and other times when you feel like, the heck with it?
Well, but I also think that those thin photos were, if I had just been sick. I had been sick for a while, so I had lost a lot of weight that way. But Yeah, I think all people, you have to sort out, you know, what you are and who you are. And wanting to fit in with other people's approval is an important thing, to be thin, to act straight, to write a certain kind of play, to have a certain kind of manner, not to have opinions that are unpopular. Those are important. And, you know, making a career in the arts is as political as anything else. So the people who make careers are often very good at making contacts and making the most of their personas, whatever their talents are. And some are very talented, but they do have a knack for politicizing themselves in a good way, and I don't. Unfortunately, I have almost never in my life been able to pretend to anything I didn't actually feel, but I've suffered a lot for that. I've made a lot of enemies. So.
You grew up really loving opera, and now, now you're writing plays without music. Didn't you try to write operas when you were
very young? Well, I was a composer when I was younger, but I mean, I wasn't especially talented. I was terribly ambitious. I was not, I would say, a great talent at all. I don't even think I had much of a knack, but...
Do you get pleasure in going to plays now that you're writing them yourself, or are you too critical thinking?
I think it's hard. You know, it's whenever you're in a – I'm sure if you listen to other interview programs, you probably get antsy. You know, I wouldn't have asked that question.
Well, no. I mean, one hand's turning the dial on and the other hand's turning it off, you know.
So it can be hard if you are in that profession. And also, you're caught between sympathizing a lot with people, feeling sorry for the writer if he's gotten screwed in the casting or the directing or admiring someone's guts. And sometimes you also do feel very critical because you try to face the same problems with people.
So you're working on some new plays now.
Yes, I have two that'll be done this year.
Could you tell us briefly the theme of
Well, Gus and Al is about...
That's the one you mentioned before.
Yes, Albert Inarrado gets into a time machine in despair and travels back to Vienna 1900, meets up with Gustav Mahler, Sigmund Freud, Alma Mahler, and several other people in Mahler's circle. And the other one is going to be done here in Philadelphia. It's called... Magda Returns with Kallas, and it's about a famous opera singer who has had a bunch of crises in her life and comes back to her family home in South Philadelphia and tries to start her life up anew.
Well, good luck with them.
Thank you very much.
And I thank you for talking with us about your work.
My pleasure.
My guest has been playwright Albert Inarrado, and a collection of three of his plays has just been published by the Gay Presses of New York. It's called Best Plays of Albert Inarrado, and it features The Transfiguration of Ben O'Blimpie, Gemini, and Coming of Age in Soho. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.